This is Whitley Strieber, and this is a Dreamland video presentation. You have reached the edge of the world. Today, we're talking to Mike Dupler. His new book, On the Trail of Bigfoot, Tracking the Enigmatic Giants of the Forest. Later, for subscribers, I'm going to be getting in to this whole disclosure process that's going on, because a lot is changing in the UFO, now UAP world, and we're going to be keeping up with that. We'll have George Knapp and Jeremy Corbell on Dreamland soon to talk more about it. But today, we're going a little bit behind the curtain in a direction we always love to go on Dreamland. We're talking to Mike Dupler, who is not just an armchair detective, but an actual outdoorsman who has been out there looking for Bigfoot for a good long time. Lauren Coleman says, join Mike Dupler on his journey of adventure and discovery for the enigmatic giants of the forest. Okay, we're going to get into this question. Why? What are these things? And why do they never get caught? Mike Dupler, welcome to Dreamland. Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. And I'm so excited because the book, I have to admit, I'm always up for an adventure, God knows. And this book is one. It almost got me out into the forest, I have to admit. But let me ask you, I have a special relationship with this whole subject because Tom, who did the first search for the Yeti in the Himalayas many years ago in the 50s, was a family friend. And so that was a big deal in my childhood. And I'm still very friendly with the family. I had lunch with his niece a couple of days ago. And this question has been an enormous one for me for a long, long time. So let's start about with some of the early stories you have in the book of the Sumerians and Gigantopithecus and Beowulf. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Bigfoot's been around for a very long time in very many cultures throughout the world. There is the story of Beowulf and the Grendel type character that could possibly be a Bigfoot, the way it's described. There are groups on Facebook where they're reporting Bigfoots in England, in Ireland, and across Europe. The Native American stories of the Hairy Man or Sasquatch or Bigfoot of many names go back for centuries. Matter of fact, there was a Viking explorer, Leif Erikson, who had an encounter with a Bigfoot-type creature in the year 986, which is well over 1,000 years ago. So these have been around for a very long time. They seem like they've been around long enough to develop regional traits, like a swamp ape in Florida has different characteristics than, say, a Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest. So it's been in cultures, it's been in stories, mythology, whatever, for a very, very long time.
Now, and Kaidu in Sumerian times, that's 6,000 years ago, 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
They were talking about the Enkidu.
I mispronounced it.
Which was a Sumerian version resembling a Sasquatch-type individual, being a wild man who lived away from culture and humanity and was like a hairy type creature, described pretty much as like a Sasquatch type in like creature. I think that they could have possibly come from Africa into the Middle East and into Europe and across the ice flows into North America, which would explain some of these distant stories that are being passed down.
However, if this was something like Gigantopithecus, the great bipedal ape, and it was just that and nothing else, then these stories would be different. We would have remains. We would know they were there. Because a great ape is not going to live successfully in the human-dominated world without being discovered. Before we go there, I was very surprised in the book when you mentioned that Daniel Boone claimed to have killed one that he called a Yahoo. Could you
tell me about that? Absolutely. Yeah, that was a story passed down about Daniel Boone. I believe it was possibly in Kentucky where he had an encounter with what he called a Yahoo, which he described as a large, hairy creature of some kind that he ended up killing.
Yeah, but no remains. I mean, I guess he left it in the woods, not thinking twice about it, probably.
Exactly.
Which is, typical of that day and time. Now, you've been out in the woods a lot. Tell us when you first started going out into the woods.
Looking for Bigfoot?
I mean, you must have gotten interested in the woods before you got interested in Bigfoot, and we'll get to that.
Oh, I started squirrel hunting when I was 16. I would go with my brother-in-law. His parents had a plot of land that we went out and we squirrel hunted, and then and eventually went into deer hunting, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Where did you live?
I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
Woods. I'm from Texas, and the part of Texas, I mean, there is a part of Texas that actually has Bigfoot called the Big Thicket. But the part of Texas I was from had very scrubby trees, but I was pretty devoted to the outdoors when I was a boy as well, primarily because a lot of my friends had ranches, and we loved helping with the cattle and stuff. So you're familiar with, now at some point you get interested in Bigfoot. Why is that?
I watched the documentaries as I was growing up. They had the, back in the 60s and 70s, they had the UFO documentaries and the In Search Of series.
Oh,
if
sure.
Anybody remembers that.
I'm sure a lot of my listeners do too.
And I just ate that stuff up. It was just fascinating that anything like that could even possibly exist.
Tell us about the first time you decided to go out and look for Bigfoot.
Well, okay. I do paranormal investigating. I like to, I do ghost photography, actually. And my daughter and I were in Oregon. We went through the Shanghai tunnels in Portland, which are reported to be haunted. We rented a cabin in a Oregon State Park that was halfway between Portland and the ocean. So one morning we decided we would go to the ocean, spend the day, and we was driving the backcountry roads, and off in the distance in this field, I see these trees stuck in the ground upside down, root side up. Now, I had seen a documentary that's Myths and Monsters of Alaska, and one of the segments in that documentary was Prince of Wales Island, where the locals reported that the hairy man took blown down trees and stuck them in the ground upside down as a territory marker. I have pictures of that in my book, but I was fascinated that this could actually be Bigfoot activity. And when I got back to Ohio, I looked up hotspots on the internet and found out that Salt Fork State Park near Cambridge, Ohio, is probably the hotspot in Ohio for Sasquatch activity. I corralled my sisters to go out with me, and we went there, parked the car. We had no clue what we were doing, and we started walking a trail that goes around the lake. We wandered into a ravine, maybe 100 yards or so, and sat down. We figured we'd just sit there and listen for a while, see what we can hear or whatever. And she looked down, and she said, "That looks like a track." And in the leaf litter, there was a perfect impression of what I would call a Bigfoot track that was 18 inches long.
My word. Now, this is your first incredible attempt.
First attempt. The first time
we
went out,
yes. I've looked for Bigfoot for years and never seen a thing. Tom Slick didn't get anything much. That's incredible. And that gets me to another question that we're going to sort of circle around, but I want to just bring it up at this point. There's a definite paranormal aspect to this. And certain people have a lot more of all kinds of paranormal experiences than others. I mean, I'm one of them. I haven't had a big Bigfoot experience, but frankly, if I spent time out in the woods, I probably would. And I have to, and you mentioned ghost photography. So you started doing ghost photography and stuff before you started looking for Bigfoot, right?
Tell
us a little bit about that. When did you start that? And see, we're trying to get into why this happens to certain people. And I'm kind of on a trail of my own. Tell us about your beginning of your interest in ghost photography and the paranormal in general.
Okay, I'm sure I started out like a lot of people watching Ghost Hunters on Sci-Fi years ago when it first came out, and I was fascinated with that. Also, there's a haunted prison not far from Columbus. It's in Mansfield. It's the Ohio State Reformatory. So I decided that my wife and I would go to the reformatory and look for ghosts. It was an organized overnight ghost hunt. And all I had with me was we went to Walgreens, picked up some disposable cameras, and that was about it. So we spent the better part of the evening going through the prison, and I would take pictures here and there. And towards the end of the evening, they would have pizza and drinks for everybody so everybody could take a break, relax, whatever. And after we had pizza, we decided that, well, we're going to go ahead and go. We think we've done pretty good here. We walk out of what's called a bullpen area. We were on a landing looking down into the bullpen. I think I had one picture left, so I snapped it into the bullpen, and then we left. Once I got the film developed, that picture I took into the bullpen, I had caught a full-bodied apparition. It looked like it was sitting in a wheelchair, and I took the picture back on another visit and compared it to where we were at, and this entity was floating 3 feet off the ground. So I was hooked,
yeah.
Needless to say.
You know, you're an attractor. Your first ghost hunt, and you get an incredible picture like that. I'm fascinated by that kind of thing, by the fact that there are certain people who just get into this stuff. It gets into you. So you must have been on a tear by then. Here you are ghost hunting, interested in this. You go ghost hunting, you get a picture. Yeah, and so, I mean, you're hooked now. And folks, I hope you're hooked, because Free Dreamlanders, you're going to take a look at a few ads or listen to a few ads right now. We're talking to Mike Dupler, his new book and very fun book, On the Trail of Bigfoot, Tracking the Enigmatic Giants of the Forest. Oh, yes, I love it. It's so much fun to do this because there's something out there all around us, not just Bigfoot, ghosts, aliens. It's all real. It's all real in some way, in some way. Now, Mike, so let's circle back now to your life in Bigfoot research. We know that you, like it turns out, your first ghost hunting experience, you get a picture. Your first Bigfoot hunting experience, we left you looking at a track. Now, where were you? Now, what happens next?
Well, after we found the track, we just looked around a little bit more and didn't find anything else. So we left for that visit, but we came back a month or two later and went to the same spot, and we was looking around and we didn't see anything. We were, like I said, we were in a ravine, and we noticed on top of the hill from where we were at were these bent trees, which didn't look quite natural to us. So we climbed up on top of the hill, and we found a Bigfoot structure, which is a beam like this with logs around it. We looked around. There was no root bases. It looked like these had been placed where they were. So I took pictures. We looked around. There was some suspicious tracks, but nothing definite. But the structure was absolutely amazing. I took pictures of it, and on subsequent visits, I took pictures of the same structure, and over a period of time, I noticed that items had been added and items had been removed from the structure, changing it. And I made a determination that this could possibly be a form of communication where they're using this as a billboard. And if they change the structure of the logs or sticks or whatever, it could possibly change the message they want to convey.
Now, let's go back to this word structure. How did you know? This is the first time I've ever heard of a Bigfoot structure, was opening the pages of your book. How did you know what you were looking at? Okay,
watching
TV. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Ian Redmond and Bigfoot, the Definitive Guide.
Okay, he was on Vancouver Island, which is off the coast of British Columbia, and he was looking for Bigfoot activity, whatever he could find, tracks, and he found a Bigfoot structure on Vancouver Island that was very similar to the one that I found in Ohio. His determination was that the male Bigfoot created this as a show of dominance or a show of strength, that he can break logs and assemble them in this manner. But it seems like that type of structure that he found and the type of structure that I found are common across the country.
Yeah. Now, yeah, exactly. And I'm looking at the picture, and our video viewers are looking at the picture too. And folks, what I'm seeing, for those of you who are on audio, is basically what looks like a group of saplings or thin trees kind of put together in a cross formation, angled together and set up between two trees. So it's definitely not something that fell together like that. That's quite clear. But couldn't it have been just made by people?
Well, that's the question. And when you look for a structure such as this, the structure that I found, the structure that Ian Redmond found, are very, very similar. So if someone was going to construct these, they would have to know about them in both locations. Now, I was on a bear hunt in Nova Scotia. We were on what's called Queensland, which is the same as National Forest here in the States. And what he does is he cuts a trail through the woods and puts up a bait barrel where he puts donuts and stuff like that in to bring in the bear. but he hides the entrance from the road so nobody goes back there to contaminate it with human scent. I was in a tree stand in this area, and I looked to my right, and there was a stick structure, very similar to what I found in Ohio, very similar to what Ian Redmond found on Vancouver Island. And I could tell you for a fact that nobody had been back there. And my guide had no idea what a Bigfoot structure was. So this was definitely not hoaxed. This was an actual structure built by something.
Now, you mentioned in the book, that going back to the first structure you found 6 months later and finding changes in it. Now, I wondered if where Dr. What was his name? Redmond got his idea that it was some kind of territorial based thing, because couldn't it be a form of communication? You speculate that about that in the book.
Well, Ian Redmond was a primatologist, and he was looking for evidence of a gorilla or for a gorilla activity, and he was assuming that this structure was built as a form of dominance by a male.
As through the eyes of a primate specialist.
Exactly. That's what he was looking for, so that's what he's found. But the structure that I found, which had changed over time, if you consider that these creatures are scattered, and if they have a focal point of communication that they can alter the message and leave a new message or that type of thing, then that would be ideal for them to communicate without having to get together to actually do the communicating.
Yeah. You say in here that you think the structures are used for communication. And yeah, now
some of them are, yeah.
That gets me to the next big issue, which is we have just the most, just traces of the existence of Bigfoot. I know Tom Slick came back with what turned out to be, he thought it was the skull cap of a Yeti, but it was eventually identified as something else, something normal. And I guess probably the Sherpas, were upset that he hadn't found what he was looking for and tried to give him something that would make him happy. That's very much part of that culture. And so in any case, subsequent to that, there have been, thousands of attempts to find Bigfoot. And people have said, well, I'm going out there with a rifle and I'm going to shoot one, so forth. Daniel Boone at least claimed to have succeeded in that. So conceivably it's possible. But then again, Daniel Boone was not the most reliable witness that the world ever. He might have heard about these things and sucked up a little corn liquor and then decided, well, damn it, I'm going to say I killed one. Very possible.
Very possible.
Okay, though. We're getting now into the paranormal end of this because tell us about the evidence that does exist, that's real. There are the good tracks and any other evidence, physical.
You have the tracks, the tracks that have been cast. I have actually a cast of a handprint. You have the vocalizations, the whoops. My sister and I have actually been growled at on two separate occasions.
Exciting.
Oh, it was. If you can imagine Godzilla growling at you, then that's what this sounded like. But there is absolutely nothing in the Ohio woods that growls like that. I mean, nothing.
Well, to describe the sound, if you could.
it just went from low to high, and it was like reverberating. It just, you could almost feel the sound hit you. It's just, some people could refer to as maybe an ultrasound, which I don't think this was quite an ultrasound, but it was along those lines, but it was right. An audible sound.
Now, Bigfoot sounds have been recorded and extensively analyzed, haven't they?
Yes, yes. A lot of the sounds come back as unknown or unknown primates. I think what's going on there is we don't have the database to properly identify various sounds made. There are Bigfoot recordings, but I don't think they put them in their database as an actual sound to use to identify anything, because it is a cryptid type creature, an unrecognized creature. They don't want to add something that could be construed as incorrect.
You're talking about the database of primate sounds.
Exactly, that they compare Bigfoot howls and sounds to determine that it's something other than what they have in their database.
Now, what about things like scat and hairs? Scat, folks, is poop, if you don't know. Just to be clear to the city dwellers what we're talking about.
Now, I have never seen scat that I would consider to be Bigfoot scat in the woods. Now, there is a museum in northern Georgia, a Bigfoot museum, where they say they do have Bigfoot scat, and it is a log probably 3 foot long that had to come from something.
I think a little big.
But I don't think they determined any DNA from it or anything
not.
Like that. But not that
I wonder
aware.
If they still could. If it's not fossilized, they probably could.
I would think, yeah. I don't know how long DNA takes to degrade, but I'm sure they could find something.
Still be, well, I don't know about scat. Now, let me backtrack here. I think that the trouble with scat is it's going to have a lot of DNA in it from everything that the creature has eaten. So you're probably not going to find DNA scat in scat that's usable. Now, guess what, Free Dreamlanders? You've got a scat for a few minutes because we're taking a break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Mike Dupler, his really enjoyable adventure on pages, on the trail of Bigfoot, tracking the enigmatic giants of the forest. Now, we've talked about Bigfoot on Dreamland many, many times, but not so often with somebody who's been as intimately involved with Bigfoot as you have. So, but let's go on a little bit now about hares. There have been some hares found. That have the, any of them played out as really not a known species?
There was a DNA study done by Meldra Ketchum, and she's from Texas, who had people donate hair samples that they considered reliable Bigfoot hair samples. And she determined through this DNA that Bigfoot was a human relative. Apparently a human female copulated with a unknown primate 10,000 years ago to create the Bigfoot race as we know it today. But it's been determined that this could be flawed because of sample gathering, how trustworthy the samples were that were gathered. There was another test done by a British scientist using hair samples collected from around the world, and each and every sample collected turned out to be either bear or deer or something along those lines. There was no definite Sasquatch DNA obtained from these samples. But I'm sure there's hair out there somewhere that people's gathered and it's in their closet or in their bottom of a drawer somewhere, something like that, who people who don't have the facilities or the resources to test the DNA on these type of
things. Yeah, and also there's this elusive quality to this that we talked about at the beginning. The sense that it is a not quite a physical phenomenon, that this is something that comes in and out from another world. And you know, when the scientists first arrived on the Skinwalker Ranch, there's a famous story, we've told it on Dreamland a million times, I won't go into any detail. A huge wolf was seen in a paddock with some goats by the family just before the scientists arrived, and they shot at it. The wolf jumped out of the paddock and ran into a marsh. The scientists later found and made casts of the animal's footprints that just stopped in the middle of the marsh. And it was a 300-pound animal. In other words, it was no ordinary wolf. It was a dire wolf from the Pleistocene or from a parallel universe where the Pleistocene hasn't ended. So, could it be that they are coming in and out from another realm of some kind?
I don't believe so, because they have been around for so long. Another thing would be, what would be the physics of going from one reality to another reality? Where did they come from? Do they come from this reality or the other reality? Jeff Meldrum made a comment one time that he doesn't think that this could be interdimensional because it is so well adapted to this reality, which I go along with that. I've actually seen one. I've been close to several. I've found their tracks. I think these are flesh and blood animals, but I can't say for sure that they're not interdimensional until we get a body or a carcass or something along those lines to identify it, and then we can assign attributes that way. But I can't say they're not interdimensional. All I can say is I don't think so.
Incidentally, folks, if you want to, you mentioned Melba Ketchum. She was interviewed on Dreamland by Linda Moulton Howe some years back, and that's available in the archive. The archive's full of fascinating Bigfoot interviews and Bigfoot stories. So if you're not a subscriber, you might be tempted to take the plunge of the 5 cents a day or whatever it costs and subscribe just to explore these stories, because they're so fascinating. Now, I don't know if, you know, I'm more inclined to think that there could be a paranormal aspect to this. And the reason is that that they have not, we've never found a single carcass or anything. But if it's not paranormal,
right,
then they have, in effect, natural technology that enables them to remain very, very hidden. And now when I say technology, I don't mean some kind of strange technology. I mean just they have excellent hearing, eyesight, sense of smell, and a high level of intelligence. If they have all of those things, and I don't say necessarily a human level, but somewhere, say, between a gorilla and a human, or a capuchin and a human, and all of that skill and their all of that equipment and their knowledge of the woods, they might be able to stay hidden. But it might be getting harder because we're getting bigger and bigger. There's more human beings out there every day. So what do you think about the possibility of Bigfoot eventually being found?
It's going to happen one of these days. There's a lot of technology out there looking for them, especially drones. You get a LIDAR drone, you might be able to spot a clan of them. It's just a matter of time until something like that happens, or until they find a body. But until then, we won't know. Now, there are stories of what's called Mindspeak. No. Are you familiar with that? Mindspeak is some researchers in the field have experienced like a telepathic connection with Bigfoot. One of them is Survivor Man in his Bigfoot series.
No, are you familiar with that? But tell us. I mean, if I say yeah, and then we just go on, my listeners are going, what? So tell us about it.
A friend of mine on Facebook actually experiences this, and I have thought, okay, I do ghost photography. I do ghost hunts and that type of thing. I cannot feel a ghost. I cannot feel the presence. I'm not aware of ghosts in any way, shape, or form. I just don't have the abilities, which to me is probably a good thing. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking there are people who are aware of ghosts. They call them mediums or whatever, or can feel the presence or are sensitive to them. Okay. That type of person could be the type that can receive mind speak from Sasquatch or Bigfoot. They might have the ability to do that, but it takes that ability to do that.
Well, you know, I'm not going to go down this road today, but there are people who can do that. And I'm well aware of some of them.
Right.
And I'll tell you right now, they are absolutely in control. You don't see them unless they want you to, because they're going to know who you are and where you are long before you show up. If this animal has that ability, then basically forget it as far as anything is concerned. You're never going to find them, I don't think. And now, here's another question, though. Why are they so shy? Are they afraid of us? Do they dislike us, do you think? Do you think there's a sense of threat out there at times, for sure?
Well, one of the possible explanations for the extinction of Gigantopithecus is that Homo erectus hunted them to extinction. That's a theory that's in the scientific community. It could be that eons ago, the Bigfoot had the same type of situation to where they were hunted by humans and pre-humans, and that's just a memory that they passed on. Like most cultures have a flood story, a legend of a great flood,
right,
like in the Bible or Mesopotamia, that type of thing. And that could be the same type of memory that they're passing on.
So
that could be why they're so elusive and so aloof from humans, is because of repressed memories of eons ago they were hunted by humans.
Well, not so long ago, Boone was telling the truth. Now, you mentioned a very interesting structure. The trees in it are sort of bowed over, and you say that you think it might be an artistic structure. Could you explain what you're talking about there and where you're going with that?
Okay, this was in Ohio, and my sister and I found arched pine trees. There was a section of pine trees that were just arched over the trail. Now, the pine trees around them weren't like that. It doesn't snow that much in Ohio to create a snow load for them to do that. It just looks like they were just arched over. And one thought that I had was they could have used these when they hit the ground on the other side, they could use those for like a shelter or something. But over time, going back to the same spots, the pine trees were woven together at the top, which is probably 10 feet off the ground, which there's no reason to do this. It's nothing to do with survival or that type of thing. It wouldn't be a shelter. It has to be possibly artistic expression. It looks pretty.
No one would. I don't think people could do it without a lot of ladders and things.
It's back in the woods. You would have to have ladders back there. There was no ropes involved or any bindings. They were just woven together.
And there's no way that could happen just naturally, I'm assuming. Or am I? No.
No, absolutely not. The wind's not going to do that, and snow's not going to do that, and weather's not going to do that.
One of the furious Bigfoot shows I've ever done, because we're talking now, folks, about something that really was created by someone else that might have seen with his own eyes.
Exactly.
I find that really wonderful and fascinating. It's why this show exists in many ways, is to, you know, to challenge the edge of the known. And, you know, you're out there. How did it feel when you first found this?
One thing that I thought about was the many structures that they make. Okay, the one that we found on top of the hill that they changed over time, I think that could be possibly communication. But some of the structures are just, there are so many different types of structures. I mean, the variations is incredible. That it's like they have so much imagination to do these type of things. And some of the structures that I've seen that do repeat could possibly be like homage to maybe a nature spirit or that type of thing, where they're honoring nature because that's exactly where they live. That's their environment. That's their home.
If they have the ability to read thought, then I know I'm not even going to get into this because it's a real sensitive subject, but let me just rephrase this. If they have the ability to read thought, then they also would have a completely different relationship with this universe than we do. They would be very different inside in their minds and hearts because they would, for example, be able to, they would live in a kind of weave of beings. In other words, they would all be aware of each other's presence and so far as they could read distant thought. But I have enough experience of this to know that for people who can do it, at least, distance is significant. In other words, they're not going to do it over 5 miles, but they might do it over 500 feet. So you could be looking at a creature with extraordinary capabilities, extraordinary sense of smell, extraordinary eyesight, extraordinary hearing, great physical strength, power, and speed, and the ability to detect you long before you arrive on the scene.
Now, I don't think that they would have the ability to understand our words,
that is
reading our minds. But I think they could possibly understand
people always think that reading thought has to do with understanding words. It does not. It's a very, very different process. A person can keep their secrets and still be read, believe me. But they would be able to detect that human presence, definitely, from a long way away. Now, what about, you make a point in the book regarding these structures about ritualistic behavior. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that might be the case and why it's important? And if there's an artistic expression going on, then, you know, you're certainly not talking about an ape. You're talking about something else.
Well, humans are very ritualistic. I mean, everywhere. You know, it's everywhere from day one. I'm not saying that Bigfoot has human tendencies, but it could be a tendency of intelligence to have, like I said, structures that honor possibly nature, that type of thing. This is their environment. They take care of it. They respect it. They honor it. They cherish it.
It's what they have. They don't have this. They don't have anything.
Exactly.
And they know that.
Right.
You're out there with a gun looking for bear and deer, and a lot of other people are out there with guns. That must be very concerning to them.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure it is. Come deer season, I'm sure they're way back in the woods, you know, back where humans don't
go. Listen, I used to like to walk the woods when we had our cabin. There's a lot of woods around there. I would not walk them during deer season, even in an orange vest, because people get too excited and they see some movement in the brush and they start taking shots.
Absolutely not.
Although I have to say that the woods behind my house were not very much frequented by hunters, because the stories about those woods in the neighborhood were pretty scary. So we have a possibility of ritualistic behavior. We've got a theory, at least, as to why they can't be caught. That's not a paranormal theory. Now, I don't agree with you. I think there is a paranormal component, personally. But that's, you know, we're not here to necessarily dance to the same tune. And you have more experience with this than I do, and you may very well be right. Tell us about, you've had some actual encounters now. You've taken pictures on there in your book.
I've had several encounters with them. As far as the paranormal aspect of it goes, I was investigating one time and my shutter motor went out on my point and shoot camera. So I was using my night vision camera in a daytime mode, the camera that I hunt ghosts with. And I took pictures in a Bigfoot active area. And this is in the book also. I took a picture of what looks like a Bigfoot face impressed in the environment. And I'm thinking, well, this is a Bigfoot active area, and I'm catching this Bigfoot face impressed in the environment. What I thought was this could be possibly a form of remote viewing that they could use. I know the CIA and other organizations theoretically have used remote viewing over the years to spy on the Russians and the Chinese and
vice versa is the important part. The Russians have taken this a lot farther than we have, unfortunately for us.
Right. But if we can do this, then you would think that this could possibly be primate activity. Not exclusively for us, but as a primate, we can do it. Another intelligent primate could possibly do it too. And use like a remote viewing type as a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah, well, our remote viewing project was shut down by Congress because Christian fundamentalists in Congress thought it was demonic. Unfortunately, the Russians did not shut theirs down, and which is going to, if what has happened ever comes out, it's going to prove to be a pretty big problem. Now, this creature, what do we know about its habits? Like, what do you think they eat, and how big are their territories? How many of them are out there? That's a lot.
I think there's a lot more out there than people
think.
Well,
if they can read minds, if they can thought read, and they can therefore and have all of that detection capability, they are in control of their situation in ways that we don't understand at all. Exactly.
Now, exactly.
But what about their habit? Like, what do they eat? Are they carnivorous? Or
I'm sure they're... Well, one school of thought is they rely on deer. There have been a lot of suspicious deer kills in Bigfoot active areas. Deers are Mother Nature's grocery store.
Sure are. Listen, I grew up in Texas where deer season meant venison season and sausage and all kinds of things. It's tragic. We lost our entire herd of axis in the freeze that happened a few months ago. Apparently, they think it's between 80% and 100% of all axis. All the axis on any of the places of friends and family all died. But in any case, the whitetails didn't because. And they're still around. Tell us a little bit about some of these unexplainable kills, some of these strange kills.
What they find is the legs of the deer are broken. Like they could take a deer down possibly with a rock. They have tremendous upper body strength, and they've been known to throw rocks. They could take a deer out with a rock from a considerable distance and to stun it. And then when they reach the downed deer, they break the legs so they can't run. And then they process it from there.
When you say process,
there's been a lot of stuff.
What are the carcasses like?
Stripped pretty much like a predator would.
No sign of tool use. Like stone. Stone tools.
I think it's just bare hand. Mm-hmm. But they leave pretty much the innards and eat, you know, the good stuff, hindquarters, meat, backstrap, that type of thing.
Any instances of reports, credible reports, that suggest that they might sometimes come closer to the human community, like in the edges of towns and things like that? I've read stories about people who saw them, like right on their front porch and stuff.
The ones that I have encountered have not been far from human activity. They have not been far from roads, trails, parks, whatever. Because I don't go that far back in the woods, especially if I have my sister with me. The two occasions we were growled at, we were on top of a hill right above the main road going into the park. They weren't far from human activity, but they, on top of the hill from where we were at, they could see for quite a ways. So there's no way you could sneak up on them, especially if they were using extrasensory perceptions.
Yeah, well, I think that thought reading isn't an extrasensory perception. It's simply a perception that people who don't have it choose not to believe in. But if I don't have it, certainly, but I mean, I've experienced it. I've been with people who do have it, and it's creepy, but it's real. It's very real. To try playing cards sometimes, somebody like that, you'll have a lot of fun, believe me. They always know where you are. They don't necessarily know your hand, but they know what you think about it for sure. So you can't get very far with that. Although I'd have to admit it was a hilarious experience, and I wish I could go into it more deeply, but I don't want these people to get pissed off at me. So because they're not, I haven't seen any of them in years and years, I have to admit. But they would come up to the cabin every once in a while in upstate New York, and they were just people, but they just had extraordinary abilities. Okay, right. So what do you think the future of Bigfoot research is? We're just coming sort of up to the end of our hour together. And
I would say that the future of Bigfoot research would be technology and boots on the ground, looking for evidence and using technology to find more evidence. That would be my opinion. Like I said, the use of drones, that type of thing, even using like Google satellite or something to pull up an area and actually look for anomalous things in that area. I think it's going to boil down to pretty much to technology.
In a way, I hope it remains a mystery. It's funny, but I think that if we identify them and locate their habitats, that's going to be a pretty tragic thing for them. Absolutely. We are encountered after all.
Exactly. Unless they could move further into the woods away from us. But I think that they're close by is to keep an eye on us. I think they have us pretty much pegged. I have a theory that when somebody sees a Bigfoot in the woods, when they report it, then what do you have? You have 20 people in the same woods looking for Bigfoot. I think at times they let themselves be seen in one area as to draw people away from another area that they don't want us in, where their young could be or habitat or something like that.
It's diversionary tactics. Because they,
exactly,
whatever they are, whether they're paranormal or not, they definitely know their forests really very well. Very indeed.
Exactly. Well,
I think that, as I say, we have an area of disagreement, because I think they are paranormal in the sense that the same sense that the wolf that showed up at the Skinwalker Ranch was considered a paranormal animal. I think there are creatures who have evolved an ability to pass back and forth between this universe and the parallel universe as a survival skill. And I think those creatures probably some of them also have the thought reading. That's my own opinion. But that doesn't mean, I don't think that we will find them here. And here's my question, my last question. If we find a Bigfoot, a real Bigfoot, and capture it or bring in a corpse, what do you think will happen then in the human world?
The government will probably take it and hide it.
I wonder if that's true. I think it might, but it would do that. Why would it do that?
There are different theories out there. One theory is to protect the logging industry, which I don't think that's a valid reason, because I'm in Tennessee and they do a lot of logging here, and there are Bigfoot here. I have an active area that I research, and there's logging going on there. They simply move to areas where it's too, where the slopes are too much for equipment to get into. So those areas aren't logged, and they know that. So they stay more in these areas than, say, a flat area where they're going to come in and take all the pine trees out.
And on that note, Mike Dupler, the author of On the Trail of Bigfoot, Tracking the Enigmatic Giants of the Forest. May you prosper in your journey, Mike, both in the exploration of ghosts and in the exploration of Bigfoot and all the other fascinating things you do. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to say goodbye now. Subscribers, stay tuned, because I am going to go through where we are now with the coming DOD revelations and what I think is probably going to be revealed and what it all means and what some of the reaction responses to it are. It's going to be an important half hour for sure. So, Mike, thank you very much for being with us on Dreamland. Well, now it's just us. I think most of you are like me, close encounter witnesses, or perhaps you have one in your family, or you are, you think maybe one, or you just take an unusually high level of interest in this phenomenon. Now, a lot is changing soon. Chris Mellon has said on numerous TV show, radio shows, I say podcasts, I don't think he said this on TV yet, that there is going to be a significant release of information and documents from the DOD in June, and apparently on June the 1st, in just a few weeks, in other words. I am enough familiar with him to know that he thinks it's going to be a world-changing event, and he may be right. He's certainly in a position to know. I'll give you an idea of who he is. He is a member of the Mellon family, who are one of the old American families. They made their fortune in the steel industry in Pittsburgh, and he's very much part of what QAnon identifies as the elite of, you know, I have to say that these stories of, I don't know, blood drinking or whatever they are, they leave me completely cold. I don't see any reason to believe any of that. That is not to say that there is not a lot of secrecy surrounding the UFO phenomenon, because there is. And the extent of it, the depth of it, I can't say that I'm sure of. Someone like Rich Dolan would say there's a whole deep state, a whole hidden state out there. And I there may, to an extent, be something along those lines that's true. And the reason is that there has been an effort made for a long, long time to understand this stuff. I know that there has been a lot of work done in metallurgy. I suspect that most of that has been done outside of the context of the U.S. government. And I will say this, that if there are things released by the Department of the Navy, there will be video, there will be speculative analysis, and there will be metallurgical analysis. I do not think that they have possession of any bodies. Or I could be wrong about any of this, but that, I don't think so. I understand that the United States Air Force declines to be involved, and if you do see something from them, it's liable to be some innocuous thing saying, well, this is all we have. The reason is, I think that they've been in a shooting war with visitors for a long time, and they don't want to say that, and they can't say that they are living in violation of their most fundamental responsibility, which is to protect Americans from threats from above. Now, with regard to the threat idea, a lot of us don't agree with that, because we've basically learned to live with the visitors. They were very damn threatening in my life at first, for sure. But I live with them now. They're in my life. I made a couple of veiled references in Dreamland in the show with Mike Dupler just now, to the fact that there are people out there who can read minds. And I think those people are somehow connected with the visitors and may even be hybridized with them in some way. The one that I met, I've talked about many times, the little fellow that looked about 11 years old, was very, very troubled. But at the same time, he was able to read my mind. I could tell he was not able to read the words, but he was inside my mind at times when he was standing nearby. And it was not a pleasant experience. I think that he had a very schizophrenic affect. He was smoked constantly, as I've said, and I think that was because he couldn't turn off the voices in his head. And he used nicotine to quiet them. But in his head, the voices weren't schizophrenics' voices, self-generated voices. They were the voices of other people. So those people exist, and I think that some of them are they used to come up to the cabin. I've not talked about much, and were pretty much normal people, except that they do. You didn't want to play cards with them, as I said to Mike, because you were going to lose. So those kinds of people exist. Now, what is happening is really very remarkable. And here's why I think that's true. The visitors told me years and years ago a number of things that are coming true right now. They told me that many of us would go insane, and I think that's happening. I think that's why so many wild conspiracy theories are beginning to be believed. People have stopped believing facts and started believing what they wish was true or what they fear is true. They've become unmoored. And if you look back at the history of QAnon, something very interesting happens. 2016, it wasn't a big deal. 2017, Leslie Keene, Ralph Blumenthal, release the explosive Tic Tac story in the New York Times. Everybody realizes that the UFO phenomenon, which has always been laughed at and poo-pooed, is real. The first thing Seth Shostak said when he was confronted with these videos was, oh, those are reflections on the pilots' cockpits. And in other words, it's a mistake. He's taking a picture out of his cockpit, and he doesn't realize it's a reflection. The old story. Of course, they were in fact taken by highly sophisticated cameras, so that story kind of went away. People began to flock to QAnon. Because the awareness that there was a real conspiracy there became very palpable at that point. Recently, I've had people send me angry emails about my basic not believing QAnon, saying, well, you believe in all these conspiracy theories. Why don't you believe in QAnon? Because it's a bridge too far. They've taken it into the fantasy world, but that doesn't mean that some kind of deep state doesn't exist, because I think it must. It must. Why is it coming out now? Well, the other thing that I heard from the visitors was that as the planet situation became untenable, they would become more and more present. I don't think if they actually physically appear, and I don't think that's going to happen this summer. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. It's going to be pleasant for us, because they're going to be in a situation they don't want to be in. They want to live behind the scenes and experience our sense of newness and wonder. We've talked about that on this show many times, and in my books I talk about it. If they end up out in front, they don't have that anymore. We are now all focused toward them. They don't want that. That ruins their reason for being here. So if they have, they're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. It's beginning to look like if they don't come out, we are going to let ourselves go extinct or be so terribly damaged that we are basically, to be frank, no fun for them anymore. Not the rich source of wonder and excitement that they experience now. So they're going to be angry, I think, if they come out. And I think that they're going to be pretty difficult to deal with, would be my guess, especially for people and countries that have not done much of anything to preserve life on Earth. And like right now, as of right now, I saw in Forbes magazine today a story that China emissions now equal the emissions, the carbon dioxide emissions and so forth, of everyone else combined, the whole planet. Will the visitors come after them? I don't know. Will they come after us? I don't know. But I don't think they're going to be happy if they come out. If we see them showing up in large numbers, expect it to be a challenging and difficult situation for us. Will it be devastating, deadly? No. They're not here to destroy us. In fact, they'll be trying to do the exact opposite. So no, it's not going to be a scorched earth invasion or some kind of science fiction thing at all. It's going to be something very different. And they are so very different that I don't have any idea what form it will take. But one thing you can be sure of, it will be surprising. So I saw on Stars and Stripes website a few weeks ago, getting back to Chris Mellon, an interview with Chris Mellon, who was describing how that might be necessary to and important to work on the whole issue of weapons, that we might need weapons to defend ourselves against the visitors. And if you will recall, if you've read A New World, I say in it that one of my thoughts is that they may actually want that. The reason being that it's empowering to us. We're not helpless then. And if we are empowered and can at least have the illusion that we can control our relationship, our side of the relationship in some way, we might be better able to handle this. Could we win a war with them? Of course not, for the very simple reason that to win a war, you have to be able to reach the enemy's heartland. You have to be able to know where he's coming from to affect his supply lines. We can't do any of that. All we can do is bite the boot that's kicking us. We can't go off and do anything to the man above. So, no, of course not. And would it be stupid to fight them? Of course it would. I think it would be very stupid. Recently I saw Stephen Greer was on the Alex Jones show. I don't ever watch the Alex Jones show, but someone sent me a link because Greer was on it, talking about how there was going to be a false flag alien invasion. I hope I'm getting this right. A false flag alien invasion with flying saucers that were actually built by us, and we were going to be made to think it was an alien invasion by the government, the deep state, which is mortally afraid of the visitors and wants them to go away or something. I lost track of the logic. Anyway, he's ended up calling himself the Paul Revere of disclosure now. I think he's probably fairly outside of the whole disclosure process. I get a few bits of information here and there. The ones who want to keep secrets are careful because they know that I will share with you. I'm not here to keep secrets. I have no security clearance. I don't want one. And the reason is that's not my job. My job is to share what I know. In any case, I think what Greer is saying is probably quite unlikely to happen, or maybe even impossible. I think his fear is that the visitors are going to be portrayed as something very dangerous. And he's reacting to that, I think overreacting to it, actually. I think it's quite likely that that will happen. And I believe the reason will be because of us, the abductees. I would be surprised if anything comes out admitting that our abductions are a real thing. I noticed two articles in the New Yorker recently, and the New Yorker is going to play an important role in all of this, by the way. The first article was about Elizabeth Loftus, who was a member of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and who is a believer. Essentially, it comes down to any really unusual memory is false. That's what it comes down to. I don't think she would agree with that description of her beliefs, but I think that is correct. It was a pretty complimentary and favorable article. It failed to mention a few things about the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. It failed to mention that the daughter of the founders, Jennifer Fried, wrote a book called Betrayal Trauma, claiming two things. She herself is a psychologist and Harvard-educated psychologist, that the two founders, her parents, had abused her, and that the whole false memory idea is itself false. And she implies in her book that it is there to shield abusers, that the foundation is there to shield abusers. And she points out that one of the original board members was a contributor to a Dutch magazine called Padia, where he was saying that man-boy love is neither wrong, not only not wrong, it's not bad for the boy. It's good for the boy. In other words, he had every reason to belong to something called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. And so, but that's not mentioned too much. It's brushed on maybe in the article, I forget. But it's a complimentary article, and it establishes a kind of baseline that we are to respect authorities who think that all strange memories are false. There was also on a website that I have in my mind associated to a degree with what I would say that is the sort of the level, the secret level, let me put it that way. I'm not going to say its name because I'm not sure that it is connected with that. And it's a well-respected UFO website. If I ever have proof, I will say its name. But I was interested in an article that appeared on the website saying basically that hypnosis generates false memories. That's not wrong. Believe me, it is possible to do that. But it's also possible for a good hypnotist to elicit more information legitimately by enabling the subject to concentrate. That's exactly what Don Klein did for me, and why my hypnosis sessions, I think, are incredibly accurate. I think they are exactly what really happened. Now, so those are those two things. Now, the next thing in the New Yorker is a lovely article about Leslie King, a dear personal friend. She had a long history with Bud. You know, Bud and I didn't have any problem with Bud, but Bud was not happy because I didn't agree with him about certain things. And also, you know, I have a bigger public presence, and he had worked all of his life on this, and his public presence remained very small. He felt me like that I was an interloper, and it affected his ego and made him angry at me. I accepted all of this. And Leslie understands it too. Leslie and I have been close friends for a very long time. And Anne also. She knew Anne. And it's a wonderful article about Leslie and her work and the decision process that she made coming into an acceptance of the reality of the UFO phenomenon. So you have two things there just a few weeks apart. One, the false memory syndrome lady saying, who says essentially all unusual memories are false. And two, a good article about Leslie Keene saying, supportive of her, the fact that she was, she believes that UFOs are something real. You see this, what this adds up to? Yes, we're going to admit that UFOs are real. No, we're going to say all those people, it's just folklore and hypnosis generated false memories. Why would they do that? Because they cannot control this, is the reason. They cannot control it. And they are scared too. And so you then ask, if they can't control it, and they are scared too, why is anything coming out at all? Why did anything show up? Why did Lou Elizondo suddenly come out in 2017? Well, the explanation is that his program was defunded and he got mad and released a bunch of stuff. And that could be true partially. But you have to understand the visitors are real. And when I was talking with Mike Dupler about mind control, I mean, about ability to read thoughts, boy, are they good at that. Oh, yeah. Not only can they read thoughts, but you have to be carefully trained. You have to train yourself because nobody's going to do it for you. How to understand yourself well enough so that when they decide to move your thoughts, you make the final decision as to what you want to do. You have to preserve your will. And if you don't know this can happen, you become a tool. And I think maybe that's what happened to Lou. I think he became their tool. Because they are definitely wanting us to survive. And I think they've made the decision that they want us to survive, even if it reduces the effectiveness for them of the relationship. Now, I can teach people how to let them in such a way that it is beneficial for everybody, because that's how I live. This is my life. The last three books I wrote, Afterlife Revolution, A New World, and Jesus, A New Vision, are literally light years beyond anything else I've ever written except Communion, which was written with them too. But I didn't know it at the time because I learned how to use my relationship with them and with the human dead, who are just a huge part of this. And that's something that certainly the secret government doesn't know and can't control. I know this can work. I know that what contact is about. It's about this sharing. Anne knew it from the beginning. She was something really special. You realize at the very beginning, she was the one who said the book should be called Communion. She came into this world to make contact happen. She called it Communion. She created the Afterlife Revolution and proved in that book that the dead still exist. I mean, that's a really incredible person back there looking at us, for sure. Oh, and she seemed like such a nice little, she didn't present herself as a guru or anything like that at all. She was a very sharp-witted, sharp-edged, she had a temper, a woman, very brilliant. And she did all of this. And I wonder to this day and ever more every day as things begin to fall together, how much did my wife really know? We found each other seemingly by accident in New York using a dating service called MindMates for people, smart people who wanted other smart people. And I just wonder if the visitors weren't involved in that from the very beginning. So, speaking of mind control, I would have been completely open to that in those days. And I am now too. I mean, I will, but it's a dialogue now. I mean, they don't come into my mind and make me do things or draw me along like I think they probably are the people in the intelligence community who are bringing this out. And Donald Trump, who after all is the one who made the decision in his and put in his last budget that this would be released. This would all be released. Barack Obama wouldn't do it, and it was really, in many ways, I guess it just wasn't time. It's going to be real complicated, and I think it's going to be complicated especially for us, because I think we could easily be thrown under the bus. The media wants to believe, and ordinary people want to believe, that we're all a bunch of nuts and that they don't have to worry about this. UFOs are real, but nobody's coming out of them. They're not interested in us. Of course they're coming out of them, and of course they're interested in us. If they're here and they're not interested in us, we need to be very, very worried about that. Very worried. But they're real interested in us. They're interested in us for the reasons that I have said many times. We are living in these very thick bodies in the time stream. And every moment is new to us. We are basically creatures of wonder. And they can share that wonder if we will do communion with them, like Annie wanted us to in the beginning, from the beginning. And the dead, too. I remember Mark Sims was on Dreamland a few weeks ago, and he was had his experience with a human being from the past who wanted to share his body. We're just like Annie. She shares my body right now. She shares my body all the time. I don't feel her in my body right now, but that's only because I'm not feeling it, not because she isn't sharing it. My body is available to the soul that created Anne and has now apparently created another physical body, but still is involved with me. Remember, she said, "I'm not Anne anymore, but I'll always be Anne for you." That was one of the first things she said afterwards. Because each one of us, and I'm going to conclude on this note, each one of us has a great soul that projected this person into the world to gain experience. And our job here is to send back to that soul all of the wonder, the pain, the joy, the love, all of life. And that's going to become, as the visitors come closer to us, a bigger and richer task than ever before if things go right. It won't all be fun. It won't all be sweetness and light. But it is going to happen, I think. And perhaps people behind the scenes somewhere know more for certain that it's going to happen. Perhaps they're in more direct communication with the visitors, but I think not. I think we're going in this direction because we're being drawn in it by their silent presence. So we're liable to be thrown under the bus. It's possible. And if we aren't, it'll be wonderful because it'll just mean that things proceed faster. But if we are, know this, if the media floods out with stories of, oh, UFOs are real, but these people are all nuts, know this, that will pass, will not last. In their own time, the visitors will make sure that we take the place in the relationship, which is a place of mediation, by the way, between them and the general run of humanity, that we were made and is intended that we take. Every one of us, whether we are deeply into this or just a little into this? Have one close encounter or hundreds or thousands? Has an ability to be in this in-between role, or we would not have ever been contacted in the first place. If you've even seen a UFO, you have that ability to a degree, and you can develop it. Well, okay, I'm finished for today, but we will go on with this. We're going to have George Knapp and Jeremy Corbell on Dreamland soon, and we're keeping up with this. Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon and Hal Putoff won't interview with me, and you know they because I think they don't want to get involved in the abduction stuff. And in Hal's case, he knows too many secrets. I've known Hal for 30 years, and while I don't know his secrets, I do know he knows a lot of secrets for sure. He's the real deal in that sense. Chris and Lou, I would assume, do too. But anyway, they're going to be the point people for this. Chris and Lou, I don't think Hal's going to be very present, if at all. He's not a public person, really. I just saw him again a couple of weeks ago. We had lunch together. It was lovely fun. It always is. He loves to hear stories, and he tells me stories, and we trade ideas, usually about methods of communication. He's very interested now in really new methods of communication involving quantum entanglement and stuff like that. He's a good physicist, so it's really terribly fun. I value the relationship, and I do not think he's an evil man, and I don't think any of them are evil. I don't think the deep state is evil. I think the deep state is scared, and there's a difference. I think that they hid this from the beginning because they were scared. They didn't understand it. They knew it was very provocative, and they hid it from the beginning for that reason, those reasons. So here we are, going on down the road. We will keep on keeping on with this, though, because this is a dialogue that we're gonna pursue, and we're gonna have more video sessions. I've been very, very busy lately, and with all of this stuff, and haven't been able to schedule videos, but sessions. But we will have them again, starting probably in about 2 weeks, and I will start putting notices up on the site. And if you want to join in the chat room, it's there Wednesday nights at 7 Pacific time. I'm usually there every Wednesday. And if you should wish to meditate with me on do the sensing exercise, I do it from 105 to 125 every day. And if you want to join, just write whitley@streamer.com. It's free, and you're most welcome. Thank you for being Dreamlands of the Unknown Country subscribers.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.